You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora koutou katoa and welcome to The Friday Wire. You are indeed tuned in. We're all here. We should get our own sting.
What? Why would we do that? That sounds complicated.
I don't know. I just think that would be really fun.
Well, I mean, we had hummus for a while.
We did have hummus for a while. I miss hummus. Anyway, we've got a packed show, so we just better get on with it. First up, our news director, Lillian Hanley, speaks with Urs Signa from Climate Justice Taranaki about the government's decision to end new offshore oil and gas exploration. Next up, we have our weekly chat with Jamie Lee Ross from Te Rōpū Ngā Hinara, the National Party. Following that, we are crossing the ditch again to chat with Rachel McDonald from Radio Adelaide and Neighbourhood Watch, and we catch up on the Australian headlines of the week. After that, Laura talked with University of Auckland Architecture and Planning lecturer Bill Mackay about how public transportation will die out with the rise of autonomous vehicles. Then I chat with Debbie Abbas from Palestine Solidarity New Zealand about the Great March of Return along the borders of the Gaza Strip and the inaction of the United Nations during these dire conditions. And finally, we commemorate the Golden Dawn with an interview from Joel Thomas about a documentary made in the last few weeks of Operation at the Popular Venue. And I really love opinions, and I am sure that you have some, so you should text them to me, tukuputuhi mai, text us on 5395, or why am I, call us on 309-3879.
I responded in two ways. I was obviously really delighted and happy. I felt like, you know, a victory. We're winning this. We're stopping oil and gas in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and we're taking climate change seriously because, you know, people, communities, hapu and iwi across the country have pushed hard and hard for the last decade or so. So that's really great. But at the same time, I was really disappointed to see that the government is still allowing onshore oil and gas drilling in Taranaki continuing. So it's a real shame and a missed opportunity in that way, because it does a lot of harm to the local environment and to local communities. You know, where fracking is taking place in rural areas and discharges to the environment and all of that. So it's a bit of both, you know, happiness on the one side that we're winning and grumpiness at the same time that the government didn't go all the way. And we know that we have to go all the way. We have to leave fossil fuels in the ground if we want to take climate change seriously. So yeah, a mixed bag of emotions, I suppose.
Do you think that was communicated well enough in the media? That it's not quite everything?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of people were really stoked to see the decision around offshore drilling. So a lot of focus went to that, and I suppose Taranaki, the Taranaki reality went under in those announcements, I suppose. So the fact that you know, 1,700 square kilometres of land are still potentially opened up for further block offers and drilling in onshore Taranaki is sort of going under in the national media coverage. But yeah, I mean, it's a reality for many communities here, for people who live day and night next to drilling. You know, they're fracking in Tikorangi this month. That's in rural Taranaki behind Waitara. That's the Taranaki reality, and has been since the 1860s, I suppose.
That's right. So I mean, there's a lot of fuel extraction happening in Taranaki all the time, and it has been for a long time.
Yeah.
People that don't actually live there don't really know the effects of that. What is the context?
Well, the industry is a big player of daily life in Taranaki. You know, the swimming pool in New Plymouth is named after Todd Energy, one of the oil companies that have been drilling here. You know, a lot of people, including our own whānau, are working in the industry, so that's a reality. But it's also a reality that the industry is damaging the local environment. You know, all the drilling waste has to go somewhere, and it's either injected back into Papatūānuku, back into the earth, or it's spread onto paddocks in a process that they call land farming, where they basically spread toxic drilling sludge onto dairy farm paddocks and then put cows back onto it. So it's a real, you know, problematic situation where, you know, obviously there's some gain to some parts of the community that are working in this industry, but also other parts of the community that have to live with the environmental and social and health effects of your community being turned into a gas land. And of course, on top of that, there's climate change. So those of us who are opposed to this activity, you know, there's always been people opposed to this industry in Taranaki. And I suppose we're just continuing that struggle against the fossil fuel industry.
Some of the reactions have also been concern around people losing jobs.
Yeah.
How do we mitigate that?
Someone on national radio texted in yesterday and said, you know, a 30-year notice that you might have to transition into another job is quite a long notice. You know, who else has a 30-year job security? No one does. You know, that's the reality of all our working lives. But you know, we need to transition, and we need a just transition at the same time. You know, we can't just let working people companies take all the benefits, and working people and the environment pays the cost, pays the price. So we need a just transition, but we need a transition urgently. And I'm afraid it's not going fast enough. Like we need to transition to a carbon neutral society a lot faster than we are at the moment. So yeah, we need to keep pushing, and we need to work together with unions and with workers to make sure that it's a just transition.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, mā runga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Urs Signet from Parihaka. Lillian Hanley talked to him. He is a member of Climate Justice Taranaki. So following the announcement by the government to end new offshore oil and gas exploration, he posted on Facebook about what is happening, I'm sure, at the time. So he said, alongside the good announcement, they also opened up consultation on a potential tender process of 1,703 square kilometres of onshore Taranaki. That's 23% of the Taranaki region, including some conservation land. Once consultation is complete, New Zealand Petroleum and Minerals will provide advice to the minister, who will decide the final area to be released for tender. The tender is expected to open in August 2018. Is this our nuclear-free moment? We've got to keep pushing. Companies have been fracking in Taranaki since the early 90s, discharging toxic drilling waste back into old wells or spreading it onto paddocks, flaring 24/7 discharges into streams. The government will consult hapu and iwi to identify areas of sensitivity or significance that the minister needs to be aware of. So please be active in your hapu and iwi and say this activity is not on. Stay tuned. We will be talking to Jamie Lee Ross from the National Party next and continuing to talk about this issue of oil and gas exploration on the offshores of Taranaki.
This Black Friday, the Hollywood Avondale dares you to attend Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter. You'll shriek as Jason, the hockey mask maniac, stalks Crispin Glover. You'll cheer for Corey Feldman's Dance of Death. And you'll scream with delight at the pre-show 80s horror trailers. Watch out, Jason's about. Friday the 13th, the final chapter. This Friday only at the Hollywood Avondale. Doors at 8, fun begins at 9. Tickets, $13 from the Hollywood Avondale Facebook.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
It's time for our weekly political chat with the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Kia ora, Jamie Lee. How are you going today?
Hey, Kelly. Nice to be with you.
You too. Have you got power?
I do. Although, look, I was in Wellington most of the week and no power cuts there, so I feel for my constituents. I'm sorry.
Oh, lucky for some. Able to escape to the big smoke.
Oh, I don't know about that. I was in this apartment building that sways and creaks in the wind in the middle of the night. That wasn't so pleasant. But yes, we had power, so I'm not complaining.
Very good, very good. We'll get straight into it because I know you're a busy man. This week, it's been a busy week with the announcement from the government about the stopping offshore drilling in Taranaki. I'd like you to kind of give me a little bit of an overview of National's position on this.
Well, our position is that the energy sector is both economically very good for New Zealand. It creates a lot of jobs. And actually, from an environmental perspective, some of the work we do and the gas production we have, the environmental side of this is that if countries around the world are able to use more gas production rather than using coal, then they would actually be in a better environmental position if countries like New Zealand could drill for more gas and could provide those energy needs. We also don't have long-term supply in a way in which we feel the government is making out. And I've seen some reports of the fact that we supposedly only have about 10 years left of supply in certain areas, and that's quite difficult for New Zealand in the future if we don't have mechanisms available to be able to produce our own energy. I think it's unfortunate that an environmental argument is being used to effectively kill off an industry which has been very good for New Zealand. I can understand the politics around it, and I know the Prime Minister wants to have a position that she can go on the world stage and take, but ultimately you always have to ask yourself the question, is this going to be long-term damaging for the country? If it is going to be long-term damaging for the country, then it shouldn't be done.
So I suppose the question there then, what I'm curious about is the long-term damage to the country for a lot of people is the drilling, because that is what is damaging physically, you know, tangibly the country, rather than the economic side of things, which I think is where you're coming from. Does National, you know, I think the view that a lot of people are getting, and correct me if I'm wrong, that National, you know, sees economic development as more important than environmental sustainability.
Well, if the government was being consistent and the government did have that concern, why did they say no to offshore but yes to onshore? That's not a consistent argument from the government. Look, the reality is we have got a decade or less of gas that runs much of our industries around the country, particularly in the North Island. A large number of homes and schools and hospitals and places where we all go utilise gas. If we cut off that ability to have greater gas opportunities in the future, that will ultimately mean there's a greater cost for us to bring in and import that energy ourselves, or we have to start turning towards the likes of coal, and that would actually hurt us environmentally as well. I think it's a nice soundbite that sounds good out there when you're standing up in front of a crowd, but actually when it comes to jobs for New Zealand, when it comes to energy opportunities in the future, it is going to hurt New Zealand. And there are people, real people, that have real jobs in the sector, and we have real people that live in the region that have done very well out of the energy sector and out of New Zealand exploring more energy opportunities that are actually not as environmentally bad as the government's making out. Those are the people that will be hurt by this.
So the government, the current government, is currently moving towards being carbon neutral by 2050. Well, this is what they're saying. Whether or not this is indeed the case is yet to be seen. However, I want to know if, you know, the question I sort of asked before, if you were in government, if National was in government, is this something that you would want to move towards?
Oh, the National government was making steps as well.
What were the steps?
Well, we were ensuring that we signed up to international agreements. We were ensuring that we were taking steps as a country to reduce, we have very high renewable energy use as if we're talking just about energy and about our production. Our country has very high renewable energy use. In fact, many countries around the world would be jealous of the situation that New Zealand's in when it comes to energy. Everything you do as a government has to be a balance, though. And whilst the government's making some decisions which might sound good in a headline, there's 8,000 jobs, there's $2.5 billion of economic value that will be lost by this decision, and there's a very real chance that we won't have the energy supply available from a gas perspective that we otherwise would have, and there's a very real chance that there'll be higher costs for New Zealanders in the future if we have to import more energy when we look at gas.
Is hydro energy something that National would look at moving towards more holistically?
We need more as a globe, as a country. All countries around the world need to move more towards renewable energy sources. We do very well when it comes to renewable energy sources. And if an economic case can stack up, which can show that you can provide a renewable energy source other than what we have already, and you can ensure that costs are kept under control, then we should seriously consider that. Our position on this is that the exploration opportunities that are now being cut off by the decision the government's made will lead to potentially less environmentally friendly outcomes, and it will also lead to less economic outcomes for the country too. Sounds good in the headline, isn't good for the country.
Awesome. Well, I think we'll leave it there for now, but thank you so much for joining us, Jamie Lee, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to chat about again next week.
Thanks, Kelly.
See you later. You too.
That was the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross. The Wire.
That was indeed the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross, and there is so much to be said about this topic, and I think you should text in. I've had a couple of people already text in. We can't stop doing the wrong thing because people are making profit from it. Absolutely. I think that's the sentiment a lot of people are trying to portray, that the economic growth isn't actually necessarily what everybody values. So that's definitely something we need to push. Somebody else has said, why is fracking still happening in New Zealand? Great question. We are going to be joined with Rachel McDonald next about the headlines over in Australia. So hopefully nothing bad environmentally happenings over there, but we will soon find out. So stay tuned on BFM. 5395 is the number to text.
I was calling through a festival way out west. I was thinking about love and the acid test. At first I got real dizzy with a real rocking gang. And then I saw the coma girl on the excitement gang. And the rain. Burger van. Somebody was wailing off their head. Oh, nobody is ripping the teen scene dead. And the rain came in from the white blue yonder. I thought you and me might wander. The 19th hour was falling upon Desolation Road. So my love band at the last drop on the go. Let's siphon up some gas. Let's get this show on the road. Said the coma girl to the excitement gang. Into action, everybody sprang. The old drums were beating out too lang, too lang. Coma girl of the excitement gang. Oh, Mona Lisa on a motorcycle gang.
So in line with the Wire Worry Week, Laura spoke with the lecturer of architecture, Bill Mackay. He primarily focuses on urban planning and believes autonomous or self-driving vehicles are going to cause a complete restructuring of our cities and wipe out the need for public transportation. So she started by asking him how autonomous vehicles are going to change our urban landscapes.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
I think they'll change them in a much more radical way than people will think. It's basically parked cars use up, and cars are parked 90% of the time, they use up a phenomenal amount of space. We're going to have a lot of asphalt to deal with.
How do you think that is going to change public transportation in cities?
I think we'll see the rise of the equivalent of Uber, because if you've got a driverless car, you're not going to park it. You're going to have it out there being a little autonomous Uber for you. So all around the world, people are predicting that we'll have much more in the way of cars circulating that you can hail all the time, but we'll have a lot fewer cars on the road because the whole system will be running much more efficiently.
Do you think that is something that we should be concerned about in terms of economic shifts away from public transportation?
Yeah, it does. On the upside, less cars on the road is good because cars dominate the road. And, you know, drivers are constantly complaining about pedestrians, cyclists, and public transport getting in the way and that sort of thing. But it does worry me that we end up with a kind of neoliberal public transport system that's all based on ride, kind of autonomous taxis, and that we will lose buses, trams, trains even possibly, that sort of thing. Because when you think about it, you know, and we've seen the phenomenal rise of Uber, it's much more attractive to get a cheap car exactly from A to B than it is to walk down the street a little bit and then get on public transport and then get off or have to make a change or something like that. So in a way, I know Uber have plans to dominate the globe. I'm a little bit worried about putting everything in the hands of whoever is running that service, because there's got to be a connective app or something like that, just like Uber. One of the potential problems with driverless cars is people getting in and hacking the system. So who knows where you could end up, you know, and we could see the rise of carjacking and that sort of thing as well, in the same way that we have people hacking into computers and all sorts of things like that now. In terms of public transport, the big concern is that it empties out there. The other thing that you can think about is the sense of community as well. And I regularly take a bus, and you, even though you may not actually talk to the people on the bus, there's a sense of community in that you're all standing at the bus stop together, occasionally bitching and moaning about the bus not being there, but just being with other people and that sort of thing. So we might see a bit of community fragmentation in the same way that we do with people being on their phones all the time.
Government has talked about it recently, where ride sharing is something that we're seeing being advocated for.
Yeah. The big thing, when people are talking about driverless cars and the future of asphalt and all of that sort of thing, they're talking about technological advances, and what they're not really thinking about is government and local government policy. The big tipping point for driverless cars will be at a certain point the government will say you're not allowed to drive your car anymore, even though you can, because you might kill someone. You know, in a similar way that we've seen the government step in with smoking. Smoking's different, you're only committing suicide, but if you're driving around your own car in the future, you could be committing murder. So we will see government and local government making more policy that will affect everything, and who knows where that will lead as well. Because when local government and central government make policy, it's for the greater good. We will see them stepping in, and that's something that people don't think about when they're thinking about the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it would be more of a taxing system, but I could definitely see it being something that gets banned.
Yeah.
That's also kind of an issue where we currently associate independence, our freedom growing up with being able to drive a car, and that changes our entire society. What do you think of that?
Yeah, people will look back, because we've all grown up with cars, but and I got my driver's license as soon as possible, but I've got three sons. over the age of 20, only one of them has got his driver's license, and even then it's not a full driver's license. So in urban populations, we're seeing a shift away from that. It's going to be very tricky in New Zealand because we'll have rural populations who are all driving around in utes and are using their vehicles on the farm and as well as on the road and that sort of thing. So it's going to be very tricky in terms of New Zealand. So I can see that in the future with policy making, we may well end up with more of a rural-urban divide where you can drive your car to the edge of the city, but once you get into the city, you're not allowed to drive.
But then that's also an issue of economic divide where you have the rural populations potentially getting taxed.
But when we look back as well, you know, we will look back, the era of the car was fantastic. You know, you could get into your car and just drive cross country, and the availability of the car paralleled rock and roll. We didn't have teenagers before the Second World War. We had teenagers, the phenomenon of teenagers after that, and the car and music and popular culture were all part of that sort of thing. But we'll look back on the era of cars as a bit like the Wild West, when you could just kind of get on a horse and ride off and do anything. In retrospect, we will miss a whole lot of freedom, but in the future, people will look back and say, well, it was like people smoking in buildings or doing this or doing that. How could they get away with that lawlessness?
I suppose my only final question would be, how quickly do you see these kinds of advancements happening?
It will happen faster than we think. It's dependent very much on technology, and there will be hiccups as more and more driverless cars come in. They will kill people. There will be accidents. But it will, like all technology, it will happen faster than we think. We will see the shift being some quite radical in terms of technology and adoption in urban areas. It'll be much different in rural areas. But once public policy from local government kick in, then we will see a massive shift. But I think New Zealand will be different from LA or urbanised areas like Britain and that sort of thing, and that we'll still have this rural-urban divide, and we'll have to see how that works out.
Worry Week on The Wire.
So that was Lecturer of Architecture Bill Mackay on autonomous vehicles. It's such an interesting topic. It's he gave us quite a good sort of look into what he thinks will be the future of transport. So definitely, I don't know how I feel about autonomous vehicles. It's McKay. It's Bill McKay. Not Mackay. Come on. It's McKay. Everybody knows that. Oh, I was just having a laugh. Anyway, it's something very interesting, and I'm not sure how I feel about autonomous vehicles, but if you are sure how you feel, tuku patuhi mai, you should text me, 5395, and let me know. I chat with Debbie Abbas this week. She is a spokesperson from Palestine Solidarity New Zealand. So we chat about the current situation along the Gaza Strip and the oppression of the Palestinian people at this time. So she begins by explaining to me the context of the conditions for the people right now, what they're going through, the marches, the protests that they are performing, and what the network, what her network is calling upon from the New Zealand government.
So the coastal strip, we're just talking about one area of occupied Palestine now, but it is, of course, the area that is in the most dire condition because of the siege. So the siege has been going on since 2007, a siege by Israel, almost 11 years. This siege means all borders are blocked, they're locked, so land, air and sea are tightly controlled by Israel. No one gets to leave Gaza. So there's no hope. Also, they've been the subject of three very serious attacks by Israel, which has left living conditions, you know, very, very poor. It's ranked as the third most overpopulated area in the world. So 2 million people living in 365 square kilometres, so you can imagine, with all the borders locked, no one gets to leave, subject to indiscriminate bombing whenever Israel feels like it, targeting their infrastructure, which has resulted in, you know, no clean drinking water. Obviously, overcrowding existed before. This is, of course, intensified because homes are destroyed after bombing. They're not rebuilt because the building materials are blocked by Israel. There's everything, medical supplies. So really, we're talking about catastrophic conditions. The civic community, and this has been a spontaneous march by the overwhelming, you know, large, great numbers of the Gazan population. And they're marching to the border, which has been increasingly encroached as well, because Israel have what they call a buffer zone, and they've been encroaching upon that. Because let's not forget that this is not a natural phenomenon. This is man-made, these conditions. You know, more than 70% of the population are actually refugees or the descendants of refugees from mainland Israel, you know, having had their land, property and homes confiscated.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they've been pushed into this enclave that previously Israel really wasn't very interested in. It was really just a dumping ground for an unwanted population that they, you know, didn't want to become part of their country.
So you're saying that the UN is calling this, or has called this, unlivable conditions. Are the UN doing enough? What more can the United Nations do, and what is that role?
Well, the nature of the United Nations, really, it's a paper tiger because of the nature of the veto. You know, where our superpowers control everything. It's never worked because everything's blocked. So, I mean, let's talk about the UN. They have blocked 70 resolutions currently, you know, by other nations attempting to call Israel into account, you know, to basically, you know, protest their treatment of not just the population of Gaza, you know, and the siege itself, but just generally as well, the land confiscations, you know, and the occupation, calling it illegal. Well, that's been blocked by the United States, most recently last week by Nikki Haley. So it's defunct. United Nations is defunct.
So you're asking, the network has called upon Winston Peters as the Foreign Affairs Minister to put pressure on the UN. Can the UN, you know, you're saying the UN can't do anything though, so is that...
Not with the power of veto, which is, you know, it goes against the grain of what the United Nations was established for. You know, originally the League of Nations under Woodrow Wilson's charter, you know, it was meant to give nations equality.
Mm.
After the Second World War, you know, the United Nations was then given special powers by the victors of that Second World War. And ever since then, it's really just become a talking shop. Let's talk about the Great March of Return. This is based on a United Nations resolution, 194. It's called the Right of Return. The United Nations gave Palestinians that had been expelled after the Nakba, what we call the catastrophe, which was when in 1948 Israel state became, 700,000 Palestinians were expelled and dispossessed from their land, property and their communities, totally obliterated.
Mm.
Hence they're living now in these refugee conditions. So the United Nations under the resolution UN 194 was issued back in December 1948, it called for the right of return from those dispossessed, you know, once the cessation of fighting, that they should be allowed to return. And Israel is in breach of this resolution. And they have countless others since 1948. The UN is not working. It's powerless. I want my government to speak out on this. Let's look at the statistics of what's happening on the ground at the moment. And yet our government continuously denied Palestinians not just the right to resist decades of occupation, but the very right to protest for their basic human rights. I have spoke personally just a few weeks ago to Jacinda Ardern. She has been to the occupied territories. She proudly told me so. Where is her outrage? Why is she not speaking out? Winston Peters, I'm sorry, but his party are members of Parliamentary Friends of Israel. We want to know as well more about this group and what this involves. What is their relationship? We call upon some acknowledgement of what's going on right now in this March of Return in Gaza today. We have a very famous Palestinian journalist and author coming, Ramzi Garoud. He's coming to New Zealand for the first time. He'll be touching down and doing a free talk in Auckland on the 20th of May. We are also marching in Altia Square every Saturday at 2 p.m. under the clock tower in support of the Gazans that are marching in the Great March of Return to their human rights. It means a lot to Palestinians on the ground that are fighting for justice, and we just want to make it known to them that we hear them, we see them.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
So that was indeed Debbie Abbas from the Palestine Solidarity New Zealand. A very sad situation that's going on over there. So yeah, definitely encourage you to think about some of the protests and movements that she talked about getting involved in. But anyway, you are tuned into The Wire on 95BFM, and this is a place where you can text in and tell me what you think, which somebody has done. Somebody texted me and said, one, the economic impact of sticking with fossil fuels is far, far worse, inconceivably massive, than weaning off it. Two, the economy is nothing without the environment. Great point. Three, unbelievable that he thinks imported coal/oil is the only alternative. Zero understanding of emerging and already emerged technology and adaptability to future realities. Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, and it's something that you either sort of have the value of economy or the value of environment, which is becoming quite obvious now. We're kind of seeing a divide and entrench on either side of what you value. So definitely interesting, and I'd love people to keep texting in 5395 if they would like to. We're going to have a little break, and then we're going to do something a little bit light and hear about a documentary about the Golden Dawn Tavern of Power, which was the coolest venue, but somebody made a documentary about it, and we're going to hear all about that next. So stay tuned on 95BFM.
Oh, nice pressing.
Half speed master?
Pristine grooves.
180 gram.
It's thick.
Take me. Take me now.
Oh, is that the runout etching?
Love vinyl? Us too. That's why we're broadcasting live from Southbound Records for Record Store Day. From 8, Sam Harmony and Sperber Dan will be in store spinning tunes. Then from 9, you can come join them, grab some deals, some RSD exclusive releases. There'll even be some free baking and coffee till midday. 95BFM, Record Store Day live from Southbound Records. 132 Simon Street, April 21st, 8 a.m. till 11.
Cheer up! What are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine. Women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep.
This week, public transport.
Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week, with your rotating roster of hosts.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
The Golden Dawn Tavern of Power was an Auckland music venue that many listeners would be familiar with. It has had hundreds, if not thousands, of local and international acts through its doors and surprising Ponsonby crowds with established, unknown and unusual acts. But before the bar closed last month, veteran sound engineer Bob Frisbee made it his personal task to produce and direct a concert documentary recording every single act that performed since the start of the year. So 95BFM reporter and camera operator on the doco, Joel Thomas, spoke to Bob about the documentary and the significance it had in Auckland music.
So do you want to tell me, first of all, about what this project is?
Well, the grand project is that I wanted like a time capsule of the venue Golden Dawn. It was closing down and they were going to go out with a bang. They programmed pretty much like a festival, a 69-day-long festival before they finished. And I just thought, oh, this is a great opportunity to film and record, to document a scene, a significant slice of the local music scene. And the thing about Golden Dawn is that it's not particularly genre-specific. I mean, if I think about this project, I can't think of a genre we haven't got covered, from heavy metal to folk music and contemporary classical music and electronica, hip-hop, funk. Yeah, so that was the original conceit, was to film and record every single day this year of performances. And then out of that, making a concert movie. So
when did the idea of the concert movie start? Was that sort of the original idea, or did that sort of spawn as
you
were recording?
No, it came later. I'm a big fan of concert movies. You know, when I was young, before the internet and that sort of thing, that was how we got to know kind of subcultures. So big concert movies for me were things like, you know, The Last Waltz, Dance Craze about British ska in the 70s, Woodstock, Monterey Pop, and the other ones that came out of that, the Hendrix one and Jazz on a Summer's Day.
You've talked to me earlier about sort of wanting it to be a movie for the cinema. What's the significance of that for you?
Well, it's a feature-length movie, and I want it to be quite immersive. You know, the way we're editing it is quite adventurous and poetic, and, you know, they're going to be, like, elegiac moments in the middle and, you know, reflective. We want, there's going to be ruckus stuff and reflective. It's like, I want it to be quite different to, you know, a Facebook video or a YouTube clip. You know, ultimately, I think it will probably end up on the internet, but we're mixing it in 5.1 surround and things like that. So I want to see it in the cinema.
You touched on a bit earlier about how sort of Golden Dawn's a sort of place for subcultures to thrive, I suppose. Can you tell me a bit more about why specifically Golden Dawn? I mean,
look, I think a lot of venues are important. So I don't necessarily want to overstate Golden Dawn's importance, but I think the reason why it was so successful for so long comes down to the curation skills of Matthew Crawley and his business partner in crime, Nat. He, you know, he's got a very eclectic tastes. Yeah, his booking policy was pretty healthy. And there's even sort of, it kind of, you know, it was a venue that evolved. It started as a pop-up and it did evolve. And I think there are even some architectural reasons as to why it worked. You had the performance space was the inside space. Those are people who are familiar with Golden Dawn. And then there was a covered outdoor space, which would have DJs playing and a lot of dance action. But everybody had to pay at the door and come through that performance space. Not everybody that paid was there to see the performers, but if the performances were engaged enough, they would be trapped. They would not be trapped, be captured by it. If they weren't interested, they would just go outside. And so that was a regular thing that I would see, where quite out there or unusual performances that Matthew had booked would be engaging the local Ponsonby Yuppie Yopro crowd. Other things, I mean, Matthew and everybody, in fact, everybody, not just Matthew and Nick, but all the bar staff, they were very keen on having as diverse patronage at Golden Dawn as possible, considering it was Ponsonby, but it still was definitely a wide age range at the venue, from, you know, frankly, elderly people to really young people, and just a real mix.
It seems like a big part of it that you're describing is sort of the atmosphere aspect of it. Is that something you're trying to translate onto film, or is it?
Absolutely, yeah. I was very loose with the camera people and very rarely gave them much of a brief as to focusing. I mean, if I knew that it was going to be a particularly dynamic performer, I would say, yes, let's focus on that. But basically anything that captured their eyes was fair game. And that was deliberate. I don't want, you know, just a dry balls. Oh, here's the guitar solo. The camera's moved to the guitar. So, yeah, definitely that was something that we were definitely trying to capture.
Do you think that's going to translate into being a sort of culturally important document?
I think definitely. And I mean, yeah, without necessarily thinking too high-mindedly about it, it's the sort of thing that, you know, if you watch something similar from 20 years ago or 30 years ago, that's fascinating because you see what people are wearing and the mores and even just the fashions of on stage, you know, gear they're using, the chord changes, the vocal inflections, you know, the influences. You know, if you see stuff from, you know, the New Zealand punk era or New Zealand 60s music, that's fascinating. And yes, that's, I suppose, culturally important. Yeah. I think it's a really unique situation. What I was presented with was this idea of, you know, because we had some big names programmed in the last months, you know, from Dave Dobbin, Nadia Reid, Tiny Ruins, Anthony Tonin, people like that, the Beths, and then just complete unknowns as well. And to have that all documented in a venue that then is going to disappear, I think that's kind of unique. That in itself I found interesting and was one of the reasons why I did it.
And so there's a boosted campaign happening right now.
Yep.
Tell me about why you need the funding, what it's going towards.
Well, so far I've paid for everything myself, and probably cost me about $13,000 so far. And to make the movie, I'm probably going to need another two times that again. So we launched a boosted campaign. The target was for $9,000. And basically what it's going to pay for is for the editing, the grading, turning it into a cinema. There's a format that cinemas require. And I need a big chunk of money to pay for all the music licensing as well. We're probably going to have like 25 complete songs in the movie. And then basically all the music in the movie will be being recorded live on the Golden Dawn stage in this period. So that's going to cost a bit of money. And I like the idea of that too. I like the idea of the artists getting paid money for their music, frankly.
And yeah. Like you said before, it's not just artists like Dave Dobbin, it's like unknown acts and like a whole bunch of different...
It's mainly that, yeah. So, yeah, you know, a lot of them have turned out to be the stars, you know. Been really fun mixing through the sets and picking the songs, and there are some incredible performances, really standout performances, and I think people are going to be really impressed with the quality, the sound quality. People are already impressed with the sound quality, but also the great performances. It's something a lot of artists that I've played the songs to go, oh, this actually sounds better than our album. And part of it is that the sound is there, the sound is solid, but also mainly it's because the performances are so good. Something about the Golden Dawn atmosphere and the stage and the situation brought out really great performances from people.
All right, give me your pitch. Why should people give you their money? How can they do it?
Well, actually, on Boosted, it's really easy. You just log in. It's really easy to sign up. But I'm also very careful. You know, we're not a charity. It's more that if you are interested in local music and you want to see it celebrated on the screen, this is an opportunity. We're going to have some great premiere gala screenings in cinemas, and they're going to be great fun events. And yeah, so that's the main thing. If you can go to the websites, you can see the list of artists. And if you're passionate about local music, this is an opportunity for you to see it celebrated, I suppose is a good way of putting it. There's been almost 100% enthusiasm from everybody that I encounter about this project. Like, everybody that hears about the project is really enthusiastic about it and has lots of ideas, and they're excited, and all the artists with, you know, 100%, there was no pushback from any of the artists, oh, like, no, we don't want to be part of that, or that's not our buzz, or anything like that. And so I suppose this week is about just bringing all that enthusiasm back to front of, you know, to the front of mind, and going, well, actually, there's this boosted campaign, and it's got a deadline next Wednesday, I think. So yeah, if you were enthusiastic, now is the opportunity to take part of it. And I do want a lot of people to feel ownership of the project. I'm not wanting to make a movie that alienates people. I want people to be excited, to feel that they were part of that. Oh, I shot part of that. I was there. That's me. I was on stage, or I paid for a bit of this. Yeah. Mm.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Joel Thomas chatting with Bob Frisbee about the Golden Dawn Tavern of Power. A sad story. Do you guys have any fun memories from the Golden Dawn?
I never went.
Oh, man.
What?
I know, it's so
I'm going to turn your mic off. Laura, I mean, Will, tell us the story.
I discovered it reasonably late, so like not super long before they closed.
Mm-hmm.
And man, some great nights. Just turning up as like Everywhere Else sucks. No offense, Everywhere Else, but Golden Dawn was the place.
The courtyard is the best.
Turning up and just seeing like a topless 60-year-old man like live mixing disco records is just the best thing you'll ever do with your life.
That does sound great.
A tragedy that it's gone.
I feel like such a white girl. Cassette 9 is my place.
You missed out. So the power this week. What has been happening with the power?
It went off.
For who?
I know so many people that have not had power for like... Have you still not got power?
No, I got it. It came back yesterday.
Like 30 some hours without power. Like that's actually dangerous for some people who like have...
At the moment though, you can call the council and they'll bring you a portaloo and water, I believe.
Oh, nice.
Which is good. Which is very, very good.
Yeah, actually,
however,
that's awesome.
a few days late. Maybe.
I feel like there was no warning with the storm. Like,
yeah, there was
compared
a bit of an
to
issue
the
with
last
that.
A storm we had. I remember it was my first day in the newsroom, actually, where they were talking about closing the Harbour Bridge.
My
first day ever at BFM. I had to get an interview with a guy at 6 o'clock in the morning. He was pissed.
Oh, we've got someone calling in.
Yeah.
BFM, hello.
Hello. Hey, can I get a song request?
Oh, sure.
Oh yeah, can you play some Mobb Deep?
I will see what I can do. I'll hand that on to somebody.
Oh, so you're not gonna play it?
I'm gonna ask somebody who is a music whiz, and they're gonna play it for you.
Oh, is it on this show?
It'll be on the next
show. It'll be on the next one.
We're news people. Why don't you just like say you're not gonna play it?
I will definitely try and get it played. But thank you so much for calling.
He hung up.
He was not happy.
Oh, that's so unfortunate. You know,
sorry.
We can't play that song right now, but we'll play a different song. We'll play Floor by B-Lush. The Wire's almost over, but Murray Kamik is going to come in, so you better stay tuned.
I love you.
That was The Wire.
That was The Wire for Friday, the 13th of April. Crazy, we're already in April. I'm really sorry. So The Wire is a news and current affairs, but next up is music. I'm very sorry for the people that got a little bit confused there. Kia ora rā atu. Thank you to everybody who joined us on the show today. We had Jamie Lee Ross, Debbie Abbas, Bob Frisbee, Bill McKay, and Oz Signa. And the show does not happen without Laura Quickstad and Will Parsonson, who are sitting right next to me. Thank you very much, guys. Also doesn't happen without news director Lillian Hanley. So thank you very much to her, wherever she may be, wandering around in the studio.
Somewhere.
Land of the Good Groove is coming up with Murray Kimmick, but I just wanted to quickly say I'm sorry that Rachel McDonald from Neighbourhood Watch was not able to join us today. We did say that she would be able to, but she's in the outback of Australia. And sometimes when you're in the outback, the phone just doesn't work, which is a piece of news in itself, really, isn't it?
Just, that's the news from Australia.
That's
the phones
news.
Don't work anymore.
Phones don't work. Australia is now technologically shut down. She'll be back next week and we'll have plenty more to talk about, I'm sure. So please enjoy your weekend and stay tuned to BFM because that is where the good music is.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.